This is a story of the Berlin airlift, the operation carried out by the Royal Air Force and the United States Air Force to supply 2.25 million people of Berlin with food, coal, and other necessities of life.
Hi, I'm Tobias Haberkorn, editor of Berlin Review. You're listening to Airlift, a show where we provide backstories and insights around the magazine and its themes. I'm very happy to be joined by my co-host Lauren Euler. We're speaking about Vincenzo Lotronico's Perfection, a novel that is set in Berlin's not-so-distant past and has been massively successful since its translation into English last year. The book has been called a defining millennial novel, praised on its literary merits, and also widely debated and intensely disliked. So today, Lauren and I talk about why the novel is so polarizing, what it misses, and whether the Berlin depicted in it even exists any longer. Lauren, you've been somewhat involved even, or you're very familiar with Vincenzo and the writing process of the book. So first of all, why don't you tell us about your involvement with Perfection?
I love the idea of like being friends with someone. It's just, you've been involved with the conception of their life. Yes, I'm friends with Vincenzo, and I have read the book several times. The first time I read Perfection was in Vincenzo's own translation into English.
He
self-translated it in order to pitch it around. You may or may not know that Vincenzo translates from English into Italian, so his English is about as good as it can be without being native. Mm-hmm. So he sent me a draft of it a long time ago, and actually it was wonderful in his translation, and I was sort of miffed that they retranslated it, because I would love to have, you know, the author's translation, but we can't always get what we want in the global publishing industry. But, you know, also the book is about expats in Berlin, which is something that I write about a lot, and I live every day. So that creates a complicated relationship to text sometimes, perhaps too complicated, as the recent essay in Berlin Review on the book describes a
exactly.
little bit,
we,
right?
We published, I was a bit skeptical about the book, and
you only just read it. You procrastinated.
Well, we'll get into that. I think we got a few pitches about it, and I was like, I don't know, it came out a couple of years ago in German and in Italian. It felt somehow a little too close to home, and I wasn't really keen on reviewing it at first. But then we received two actually finished texts before the Christmas break that we ran as a diptyque on the book, and one of which...
But wait, can we talk about your hesitance to publish on this? Because I think it kind of gets at like a lot of the discussion around the book, which is... partially driven by resentment of the topic. Right? Like, you're like, ugh, rolling your eyes about how the book has come out. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone's been talking about it. Is it the only book that anyone has talked about for the last year and a half? Maybe it's if you don't think about it, it kind of feels like, yes, it is the only book that anyone has talked about. That creates this like sort of classic backlash cycle, does benefit. One has benefited from that before.
Yeah, no, I mean, what happened in my specific case, it happens often to me when a work of art gets talked about too much, and I feel like I know, like from indirect sources, too much about it, then I'm reluctant to actually read or watch it myself.
But this is often
a mistake. But no, I will quote a review that came out when the German translation was appeared much quicker than the English one, mm-hmm. And it was reviewed by Erika Tomala in Süddeutsche Zeitung, and she said like it read like a feuilleton essay from 2002, and maybe a bit unfairly. I mean, we'll go into the specifics, but what this goes to show is that the book shows a sort of like stereotypical, typified Berlin experience that generational cohorts before Tronico have made. And so I felt like, okay, I know about all this. The quest of like
finding yourself, enjoying the creative freedom, the self-realization, the self-curation, etc.
Of course, none of that actually, like, no one ever finds themselves and nobody ever enjoys creative, you know what I mean? Like, the ideals. You know, a lot of what is said to be quintessentially millennial, or this, yes, this millennial specifically desire for authenticity, quote unquote, is also just what they used to say about Gen X as well, like pretty much verbatim, right? Mm-hmm. Like Gen X, you know, they want something real, they want something true, like fuck capitalism, fuck fake images. This is all the same thing. And so I wonder if maybe our, the like generational label is kind of a quick fix for selling the book, because lots of people identify. They like a lot of, yeah, millennials. They like millennials also have a lot of disposable income because they don't own property. So they have, they have all this kind of like extra money that they buy avocado toast or whatever with because they don't have any kind of future investments. But like, you know, everyone's like, I'm a millennial. They identify really quickly with this, when actually it might be the case that it is a much more universal or like perennial experience to have your sort of dreams forestalled, mm-hmm, to believe that you have been sold an idea about your life that then was a lie. You know what I mean? Like, this is actually a very classic theme in literature.
I would actually question the fact that it's really about the now. I think it's a book that is deeply sort of like historically situated in a time that he's also describing, and he's giving away his comments on the state of technology and of social media and of internet culture, gives away a specific date.
Yeah, of course.
And it's pretty clear that Tom and Anna, the two protagonists, I don't even remember if he gives away that it's Italy, but it's pretty clear that they are Italian.
He makes it seem like, they could be Spanish,
Southern
but
European,
okay.
Mediterranean.
Yeah.
So to me, it reads quite clearly that they're arriving in Berlin sometime around 2010. And then there are also some political events that punctuate or structure the narrative. I think there's a sort of break in the book, even in the book's narrative arc, and maybe also even its narrative tension, that manifests around 2015-16,
mm-hmm, yes,
with the arrival of Syrian refugees and with Tom and Anna's attempt at integrating into the political reality. I mean, he says something of like this was a rendezvous with history, that they felt like compelled to finally move out of their aesthetic concerns with curating their own life and engaging in something that is larger than them and concerning the city as a community, and they want to be part of that, and that attempt fails. And it's interesting to discuss why and how.
Yeah.
But so, I mean, the book was written between 2020 and 21,
mm-hmm,
so it's also a book that was written during the pandemic.
I don't know if that's actually that relevant for a couple of reasons.
Oh,
I think it's a little bit relevant, but like, I don't think it's so historically particular, like, or in its specificity, it can be more like all books are set at a particular time.
This is what I want to, I'm setting up my sort of like a reverse in my argument, because this is how I want to defend the book.
Are you going to be dialectical?
I'll try to.
let's go.
No, because, okay, I'm not the only one triggered or annoyed by the book's, I don't know, self-centeredness on a actually pretty petit bourgeois couple, okay? But what I will say in its defense is that he really took the time and made a huge effort and took it very, very seriously to portray this stereotypical couple. And the interesting stylistic effect is that he does it so consequently that he never breaks into like an obvious form of irony, for example. And he never breaks into a clear judgment about them. But he's also not falling into a emphasis that sort of like gives away too much emotional involvement with these characters. The stylistic flatness of the book allows him to be very, very precise in something that reads like a caricature,
mm-hmm.
but you can still take it seriously as a sort of like typology of a meaningful portion of the population of the city. So that is sort of like that is his literary accomplishment.
Well,
and then within that stylistic dispositive, he still is specific about, for example, the fact that they're Southern Europeans, that they come to Berlin at a time after the financial crisis. And this is true that at the time, and he describes this very well, there were many Southern Europeans coming to Berlin looking for work. There were many Scandinavians. And then the Americans, quote unquote, arrived at a later. And
no, they so didn't. The Americans are always here. Like this idea that there's like, this is like ahistorical. Like we have been here since 1945, famously. Like, what are you talking about? Then the Americans came. Like the Americans were here in 2002 as well. That's why Erica Tamala said it sounds like a Fiton thing from 2002. It's just that the world around Berlin has changed and English as a hegemonic dominant language mm-hmm. is becoming more and more relevant. So the Southern Europeans who come here are more resentful of the fact that they cannot get copy editing jobs because they require a native level of English because the level of English globally has risen, right?
Yeah.
What's interesting about Berlin, like changing or not, is actually a story about capital, and not about the precarious, like, petit bourgeois freelancers who come to town, like, why should an Italian come here mm-hmm. and have any more right to some kind of spectral internet job than an American, like, a U.S. American, excuse me. What is the, there's no fundamental difference, like, in that to me, right? Mm. If you're an EU citizen or you're a US citizen. Mm. The US sucks. Like, it's not a great place to live. The infrastructure is really bad. So to me, I think this like alternative history around Berlin as a city is just a little bit like personally motivated by one's own experience. I mean, maybe what I'm saying is also personally motivated. Obviously, I'm an American who comes here, but like, it's not.
Yeah. No, that is true. I mean, but my sense of reading it now in the 2020s, so the book comes out right at the time when Russia invades Ukraine and when the economical and geopolitical parameters of Europe, and I would argue specifically of Berlin, change a lot,
mm-hmm.
which is not
That's
something
true.
That you... And that is why I find it interesting to talk about it now with like a little bit of hindsight, is that it's speaking about a Berlin that is really over. That was my sensation when I read it. Like a shift happened with the pandemic or after the pandemic. And that's what for me makes this book, you know, encapsulated in the past in some way. So I asked some colleagues who are younger than the two of us and who arrived in Berlin in 2021
Ooh,
what they thought about the book.
The kids.
Yeah. And is the Gen Z experience of freelancing Berlin and of Berlin as a cityscape and so forth even understandable for them? And actually they said yes.
Yeah, of course it is, because it's actually not, it does, I mean we haven't talked about this, but the book is a pastiche, or like it's a pretty straight lift of this Georges Perec novel Things, the story of the 60s. And the core of the book, like mm-hmm. the momentum of the book, is not these signifiers of contemporaneity or whatever. It is actually like the human universal experience of having arrived too late and feeling like you're sort of disconnected from your reality, and if only you could have a sort of real authentic connection to like society or to the world, you would be happy. But instead you're filling your, I mean, this is a Western experience, you're filling your life with like special records and like nice plants and, you know, so on and so forth.
I think one of the reasons why I also had problems with relating to the book, like on a personal level, is that I never had the time or the nerve or the budget to obsess about a Danish design chair.
Well, now they have copies. They're only upset because they can't get the real Danish design. They can't get the real, echt beautiful furniture. They have to get the IKEA copies, and it's just not the same.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I can relate to the opening of the book where he's describing the perfect Airbnb apartment that then, you know, it turns out at the end of chapter two is actually something he never has, only has when he moves away for a couple of weeks and then tries to sublet. I tried once in like 2016 or 17 to sublet our apartment on Airbnb or another platform. And I had to give up because it was impossible to meet the aesthetic standards of the photography, for example. It looked just not good enough. Yes, and the amount of preparation that would have to go into making our apartment Airbnb compatible would just have been too big.
But did this cause like a great psychological rupture in you? Part that I wanted to read, which is also, I think, about the core of the book, or like the sort of like... The issue that the characters, if they can be called characters, the stereotypical characters are. So the beginning of the book is like a long description of this beautiful apartment that you then realize is based on these Airbnb photos, not like the real life. It's an Airbnb ad. And then the next chapter is called Imperfect. And then it begins. Reality didn't always live up to the pictures. In the mornings, it often would. They would check their emails and social media from bed, their faces blue from the backlit screens, looking like a young professional couple in Berlin, which is exactly what they were. Line break. But the moment they set foot in the living room, that confidence would start to falter, like a previously clear voice on a phone losing signal. Okay, so they wake up and they think that they're still in this sort of dream Airbnb, right? They like, mm-hmm. They're groggy and they're like, look at my phone on my book. It's so nice. I'm checking my emails. They look like a young professional couple in Berlin, which is exactly what they were now. And then they leave and they realize, what if they have the confidence, not just that they're happy, but that they are not even a young professional couple in Berlin, because they do not match the photo, or they feel that they do not match the photo of a young professional couple in Berlin, even though, of course, that's what they are. Right. And so you don't have to have a perfect life to be a young professional couple in Berlin. And why would you want to be that in the first place?
And why would you want to write a book about it?
Well, yeah. Well, I think also, to me, I'm like, okay, so if I wanted to write this book, what I would do is go into one of those cafes on Friedelstrasse, like a sort of sleek Scandinavian cafe, which is not the kind of cafe I like to go to. And I would look at like the most annoying people there, the people who are most kind of like, so who seem most kind of algorithmically programmed. They're wearing this sort of minimalist outfit with a couple of details that indicate the clothes are sort of expensive, but they're sophisticatedly so. Like they're not flashy, they're not fashion clothes. I would look at them and I would see that they're on their computer and they're not just like screaming, they're not like business people or whatever, and they're not doing AI. They're doing some kind of like vaguely creative, but not really creative work, right? Then I would listen to them have a conversation with their girlfriend, and then I would be like, what is this person's life like? And if I was really, really uncharitable, I would write that book, right? Like if you're like, I need to project like the saddest realistic existence I could possibly come up with onto this person.
That's what I would come up with. And that continues also to be the puzzle about the book, because what struck me when I read it is like how incredibly conformist these two characters are, the couple.
Mm-hmm. But they don't want to be, right? The sex chapter is hilarious.
They are so incredibly boring and conformist. And then they sort of like run out of ideas, and their off-ramp from the completely stereotypical and boring Berlin life is to, I don't know, open a residency in Sicily where their friends could now become guests and pay for their hospitality.
But it's people do that.
They
do it in Germany too. Uckermark, I know about it. They do it in New York, they do it everywhere. There's income. Yeah.
But I mean, the interesting thing, and we would have to ask Latronico himself about it, is of course, this is politically extremely condemnable. Like, if you come to this book from the moral high ground of the current internet generation, there's so much to hate about in this book. They never speak about money because money is never an issue.
They do speak a little bit about it, but it's not. It's just a bit uncomfortable. Like, they're like,
their class background is pretty high up. They speak about like the inheritance of the grandfather, et cetera. So there's just a number of things that puts them into, you know, a completely sorgenfrei sort of like international class. And they're not even struggling to make money with their quote-unquote graphic design jobs. It's always enough.
Mm-hmm.
And the book reads like a good portrait of Berlin up until sometime in the mid-2010s, where things changed. And I mean, what manifests in the book's narrative as this sort of like break is the refugee crisis of 2015-16. But I think in 2015-16, there are other things happening on a global and even on an algorithmic and internet scale that somehow shift things, and they can't quite get a handle on this.
Right.
Like, their life story, even their economic model of graphic designers and programmers works until that point, and then somehow it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, no one needs graphic designers and programmers.
Well, now ten years on with AI and so forth, these jobs are falling away anyways. So, and the book doesn't make any attempt at analyzing this.
Yeah, but why does it need to do
that? Or even to understand it.
But why does it? It's not an essay.
No, I don't say it has to.
Yeah.
I'm just describing what it does and what it does not.
So we've talked a lot about Berlin, but we should return to the idea or the fact
mm-hmm.
that this book was not that popular among Germans or yes. in Berlin.
Yeah.
I mean, it is popular among expats in Berlin, I believe, based on the pictures I see from the English language bookstores yes. saying that it's selling very well.
Yeah.
But it's not popular in German. It's not popular in Italian either.
Mm.
And it only became this kind of sensation in the English-speaking world.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then because of that, it was shortlisted for the International Booker.
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, I have a nasty comment to make about some of my colleagues in the American, the Anglophone literary world, which is that they seem like they live incredibly boring, homogenized lives of lost promise and like comfort without soul. Mm-hmm. And so I think when there's all these American articles about how like the novel reflects like something true about life under the algorithm and like this totalitarian pressure to curate one's life or whatever, you know, a lot of people don't feel that way. I don't feel that way. I don't identify with very much in that book at all. But I do think there's a certain class, education, creative trap that people in the Anglophone literary world fall into. And that is analogous to the characters in this book. Now, why, if you are a well-educated editor at let's not name any of the publications that I also work for, but like if you know, why is your life mimicking like a graphic designer from Italy or Southern Europe in Berlin? Because of this kind of like global homogenized culture,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Come over, sit a day or two in a cafe on Friedelstrasse and learn otherwise.
What do you mean?
I mean, the whole trap that people fall into when, as you just said,
right.
about this lore of Berlin, etc. I think if you come here and sort of like experience the reality of it, you'll quickly understand that this is actually a projection that works better, and that in that sense it makes a lot of sense that it's successful, more successful in London and New York than here.
Yeah, because
it's a pure projection.
It's a projection, and also it describes a kind of belief that your life is simply constructed through whatever is at hand, right? Yeah. So these kind of spoiled, like petit bourgeois people, they're like, well, I find this cafe soul deadening, but it's the cafe that everyone goes to. So whatever will I do? Like, just go to a different, like, shut up. You know what I mean? And I think maybe that's why you could find this book annoying, because it's like, you want to have interesting, there's a long, interesting sex chapter. You want to have interesting sex? Then go have it. But quit being a fucking baby about it.
Yeah, and spoiler alert, the two characters are not even doing that.
They try.
Okay, shall we move to maybe some final remarks about Liana Mark's piece?
Sure. Yeah.
Because she recorded it for us. So I think she does a great job summing up the novel. Like the synopsis she's giving at the beginning of the piece is pretty perfect after like reading it again and reading the piece again. But you had an issue with her main point about authenticity and the commodification of authenticity.
Now that era is over. Now the main thing that's being commodified is inauthenticity, specifically artificiality, specifically artificial intelligence, right? So actually it is a kind of time capsule. And I wanted to say that like maybe a lot of the interest in the book is not like relatability or this is an authentic reflection of my life.
Yeah.
But actually it's a nostalgic look at a recent past that will not be recovered because now it's the sort of last gasps of authenticity as a value. The sort of last moment in history. I don't want to speak too soon, but the last moment in history when authenticity was valuable. Right? Yeah. Like it's actually now.
We did actually believe in it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. But now, I mean, we would like to say that, you know, the human, the truly human is going to be more valuable. And, you know, when AI truly takes over everything as a writer, the number one thing that you say when someone says, well, AI is going to take your job is that, well, everyone always wants to read something by a human, right?
And this, Lauren, I mean, this brings me back to a thought I had earlier when you spoke about the universality of this disenchantment of the literary character that goes to the metropolis. I mean, this is a theme in 19th century literature tries to realize themselves and then it doesn't really work, you know, in English. And in that sense, it's true. And you were like, Gen X was like that. And Gen X was looking for authenticity. And then
these characters might be a thing that you do when you're in your 20s.
No, but what I think the difference between, for example, the Gen Xers or other cohorts from the millennials is sort of like the end point and the horizon that we sort of like ran into. It is a material fact that, you know, for Gen Xers, prosperity was rising, living standards were rising, and life expectancy was rising, etc. There was a reasonable expectation that you would be better off still than your boomer parents. And this is the fundamental confidence in the future that the millennial generation has lost.
Well, but is it an existential problem or actually is it really good for us? Because they don't, you know, I mean, the big joke in the U.S. is like they'll never have a Gen X president, right? Like they just lament their lost future.
Yeah, maybe it's good to live without the weight of the expectation of a better future.
Yeah, I think it definitely is. It definitely is. Or we're have sort of, I do think it's good to be a realist. Yeah.
I mean, another thing you can say in favor of the book, and that's always a great sign, you're not able to put it down. I was able to read it through, you know, despite my highly perforated attentional capacities as a media consumer and as someone who works with text. I was able to read it in one go. So that speaks in favor of
well, is that also a product of this kind of streamlining clarity of language?
Maybe it is.
Right? And I mean, lots of things are written like this now. Even sort of high level, sophisticated, I would say this is very sophisticated novel on the level of style, but it is very clear. Mm-hmm. You don't have to read the sentences twice. It's good if you read them twice, but you don't have to. It's not written in international English, which is technically incorrect English, right? Yeah. But it is written from the perspective of someone who speaks international English, which is a language that has developed so that people with many different backgrounds can understand it, right? Like that is why it is
So that's an interesting like general question always is, how do you judge a translation?
I don't say that the translation, the translation, you can't say that the translation is good because it has a double meaning, because you can say the translated, the result, the English language result is good.
Yeah.
Or the act of translation is loyal, right?
Yeah.
And these are two different things. And most people
cannot
assess the latter. Like, at some point you have to say, okay, is my priority understanding and like engagement with the text, or is it deciphering, you know, again, this is a question of purity, like what's the real, like the authentic text, right? Like do I need to read the Italian so that I understand the real text? Like that's not, it's just not worth it to me, right?
Hey, if you liked or disliked Latronico's Perfection, what else should you read?
I was thinking of a film. Uh-huh. It is a small German film from, I think, 2012 called Oh Boy. Do you know this one I'm talking about? Can we just pause for a second? The German titling convention of films in different languages is something that is incredibly bizarre. So in German, I think it's called Oh Boy. English, it has a great title, which is A Coffee in Berlin. Which is what it's about. The whole movie is about the protagonist, who's a kind of hapless rich kid in Berlin. He's trying to get someone to serve him a coffee, and there's various reasons why it doesn't work. And this is a great little motif that like structures the film. And I think it must take place like around when Anna and Tom moved to Berlin. It must be like 2010, 2011, 2012. And
probably it is. Yeah. It's a film in black and white.
Yeah, but it's a good little film.
Yes,
I think.
It is. Yeah. But I remember that one central scene where he is, I think in the evening, like ends up in a bar and starts talking to this elderly guy who speaks about Berlin in, I don't know, 1989 or something.
Yeah.
So we dive into the mythology of Berlin grounded in sort of like World War destruction and the wall, etc. And interestingly, there's none of this in Latronico.
What? There's no history.
Yeah,
this, like, because these people are totally separated. Yeah, from, they don't even fetishize like the GDR, which many expats do, right? Like they're not like, oh, it's so cool. Like the wall used to be here.
Yeah. Okay, so Oh Boy is a recommendation.
That's a recommendation. I'm trying to think of a novel.
Well, I mean, an obvious parallel would be Life Runs Allegro Pastel.
Oh, yeah.
Which, by the way, was adapted to cinema as well and just premiered on the Berlinale.
Did
just
you see it?
10 days ago. No, I was not able to go to the premiere. And however, I think the book, Life Runs, did you read it?
Yeah, of course.
I think it's very different.
It is very different.
And
what's the German perspective now?
I think Leif Rund is not interested in, he's interested in a sort of like first-hand account of what it's like to live through Berlin in around the time of the pandemic, but he doesn't want to typify, you know, he just draws from a relatable experience that he just tells and doesn't go to the great lengths that Latronico goes to typify his characters.
Yeah, I think, I mean, he's much more often compared to like Taolin, the sort of alt-lit kind
like of drifting through the surfaces.
It's just more description, right? Like it sort of allows the reader to like project a lot of stuff. If you just want to read something or experience something that has lots of like Berlin Neukölln landmarks and signs in it, you know, that she goes to Griesmüller and she goes to, you know, there's the parties that you'll remember and the restaurants and this, you know, you can have a little nostalgic or like, I know I've been there too kind of experience with it, which is, there's nothing wrong with that. But I can't remember, you know, the thing that I remember is the kind of relationship drama. And that's also something that is absent from Perfection, because it's kind of the main narrative is, you know, will they be in a, like, what's the relationship status of these characters?
I think indexicality, so, you know, plays a bigger role in Life Rund, which makes it also less translatable.
Yeah.
And which might be one of the reasons why Latronico will stand in history in 80 as, you know, the typifier for 2010s in Berlin and not life run, at least on the international and the international literary scene.
You never know what's going to happen.
It was translated, and it was well published, so yeah. It also has had its moment.
Oh, you know, there's a really good, it's a little essay. It's by Gideon Lewis Krause. Can I get an assist? City of Rumor.
Yeah,
the Compulsion City of Rumor. To Write About Berlin by Gideon Lewis Krause. That's an awesome essay.
Yeah, but it is from like 2011.
It doesn't matter.
Something.
It still works.
Yeah.
It still works. It's
I read
really
it at the time. I completely forgot about it.
It's really good. He makes some really, he's pretty funny. And I think it's still, especially if you are, I am not this. I'm a diehard Berlin defender. But if you are cynical about Berlin and its possibilities and you want to leave and complain about it, that is the good essay to read.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Lauren.
If you enjoyed this conversation, we have two essays about perfection published in Berlin Review. The first is Liana Marks' Better Living Through Self-Curation, and the second is the companion piece by Cesare Sanati. You can find these at blnreview.de. You can also listen to Liana read her essay on our podcast feed. Please consider subscribing to Berlin Review. Subscription starts at just €5 a month at blnreview.de/abo. This episode was produced by Caitlin Roberts with Najla Said and recorded in the studio of Jacobin, Germany. My name is Lauren Euler, and I'm the co-host of Airlift from Berlin Review. Thanks for listening.